Blue Mars, Cassette 4.
Embarrassed, Sax knelt to look at a specimen of Tibetan rhubarb he had almost stepped on. Little red leaves in a floret from a central red bulb. Anne was looking over his shoulder.
Is it dead?
No. He pulled off a few dead leaves from the exterior of the floret, showed her the brighter ones beneath. It's hardening for the winter already, fooled by the drop in light. Then Sax went on, as if to himself. A lot of the plants will die, though. The thermal overturn, which was when air temperatures turned colder than the ground temperatures, came more or less overnight. There won't be much chance for hardening, thus lots of winter kill. Plants are better at handling it than animals would have been, and insects are surprisingly good considering their little containers of liquid. They have supercooling cryoprotectants. They can stand whatever happens, I think. Anne was still inspecting the plant, and so Sax shut up. It's alive, he wanted to say. Insofar as the members of a biosphere depend on each other for existence, it's part of your body. How can you hate it? But then again, she wasn't taking the treatment. The ice sea was a shattered blaze of bronze and coral. The sun was setting. They would have to get back. Anne straightened and walked away, a black silhouette, silent. He could speak in her ear, even now when she was 100 meters away, then 200, a small black figure in the great sweep of the world. He didn't. It would have been an invasion of her privacy, almost of her thoughts. But how he wondered what those thoughts were. How he longed to say, "Anne, Anne, what are you thinking? Talk to me, Anne. Share your thoughts." The intense desire to talk with someone, sharp as any pain. This was what people meant when they talked about love. Or rather, this was what Sax would acknowledge to be love. Just the super heightened desire to share thoughts. That alone. "Oh, Anne, please talk to me." But she didn't talk to him. On her, the plants seemed not to have had the effect they had had on him. She seemed truly to abominate them, these little emblems of her body, as if Viriditas were no more than a cancer that the rock must suffer. Even though in the growing piles of wind-drifted snow, plants were scarcely visible anymore, it was getting dark. Another storm was sweeping in, low over the blackened copper sea. A pad of moss, a lichened rock face. Mostly it was rock alone, just as it had ever been. Nevertheless. Then as they were getting back into the refuge lock, Anne fell in a faint. On the way down she hit her head on the door jamb. Sax caught her body as she was landing on a bench against the inner wall. She was unconscious, and Sax half carried her, half dragged her all the way into the lock. Then he pulled the outer door shut, and when the lock was pumped, pulled her through the inner door into the changing room. He must have been shouting over the common band, because by the time he got her helmet off, 5 or 6 Reds were in the room, more than he had seen in the refuge so far. One of the young women who had so impeded him, the short one, turned out to be the medical person of the station, and when they got Anne up onto a rolling table that could be used as a gurney, this woman led the way to the refuge's medical clinic, and there took over. Sax helped where he could, getting Anne's walker boots off her long feet with shaking hands. His pulse rate, he checked his wrist pad, was 145 beats a minute, and he felt hot, even lightheaded. "Has she had a stroke?" he said. "Has she had a stroke?" The short woman looked surprised.
"I don't think so. She fainted, then struck her head."
"But why did she faint?"
"I don't know."
She looked at the tall young woman who sat next to the door. Sax understood that they were the senior authorities in the refuge.
"Anne left instructions for us not to put her on any kind of life support mechanism if she were ever incapacitated like this."
"No," Sax said. Very explicit instructions. She forbade it. She wrote it down.
You put her on whatever it takes to keep her alive, Sax said, his voice harsh with strain.
Everything he had said since Anne's collapse had been a surprise to him. He was a witness to his actions just as much as they were.
He heard himself say, It doesn't mean you have to keep her on it if she doesn't come around. It's just a reasonable minimum to make sure she doesn't go for nothing.
The doctor rolled her eyes at this distinction, but the tall woman sitting in the doorway looked thoughtful. Sax heard himself go on. I was on life support for some 4 days, as I understand it, and I'm glad no one decided to turn it off. It's her decision, not yours. Anyone who wants to die can do it without having to make a doctor compromise her Hippocratic oath.
The doctor rolled her eyes even more disgustedly than before, but with a glance at her colleague she began to pull Anne onto the life support bed. Sax helped her, and then she was turning on the medical AI and getting Anne out of her walker. A rangy old woman now breathing with an oxygen mask over her face. The tall woman stood and began to help the doctor, and Sax went and sat down. His own physiological symptoms were amazingly severe, marked chiefly by heat all through him, and a kind of incompetent hyperventilation, and an ache that made him want to cry. After a time, the doctor came over. Anne had fallen into a coma, she said. It looked like a small heart rhythm abnormality had caused her to faint in the first place. She was stable at the moment. Sax sat in the room. Much later, the doctor returned. Anne's wrist pad had recorded an episode of rapid irregular heartbeat at the time she fainted. Now there was still a small arrhythmia, and apparently anoxia, or the blow to the head, or both, had initiated a coma. Sax asked what exactly a coma was, and felt a sinking feeling when the doctor shrugged. It was a catch-all term, apparently, for unconscious states of a certain kind. Pupils fixed, body insensitive, and sometimes locked into decorticate postures, Anne's left arm and leg were twisted. And unconsciousness, of course. Sometimes odd vestiges of responsiveness, clenching hands and the like. Duration of coma varied widely. Some people never came out of them. Sax looked at his hands until the doctor left him alone. He sat in the room until everyone else was gone. Then he got up and stood at Anne's side, looking down at her masked face. Nothing to be done. He held her hand. It didn't clench. He held her head as he had been told Nergal had held his when he was unconscious. It felt like a useless gesture. He went to the AI screen and called up the diagnostic program. He called up Anne's medical data and ran back the heart monitor data from the incident in the lock. A small arrhythmia, yes. Rapid, irregular pattern. He fed the data into the diagnostic program and looked up heart arrhythmia on his own. There were a lot of aberrant cardiac rhythm patterns, but it appeared that Anne might have a genetic predisposition to suffer from a disorder called long QT syndrome, named for a characteristic abnormal long wave in the electrocardiogram. He called up Anne's genome and instructed the AI to run a search in the relevant regions of chromosomes 3, 7, and 11. In the gene called HERG, in her chromosome 7, the AI identified a small mutation, one reversal of adenine thymine and guanine cytosine. Small, but HERG contained instructions for the assembly of a protein that served as a potassium ion channel in the surface of heart cells, and these ion channels acted as a switch to turn off contracting heart cells. Without this break, the heart could go arrhythmic and beat too fast to pump blood effectively. Anne also appeared to have another problem with a gene on chromosome 3 called SCN5A. This gene encoded a different regulatory protein which provided a sodium ion channel on the surface of heart cells.
This channel functioned as an accelerator, and mutations here could add to the problem of rapid heartbeat. Anne had a CG bit missing. These genetic conditions were rare, but for the diagnostic AI, that was not an issue. It contained a symptomology for all known problems, no matter how rare. It seemed to consider Anne's case to be fairly straightforward, and it listed the treatments that existed to counteract the problems presented by the condition. There were a lot of them. One of the treatments suggested was the recoding of the problem genes in the course of the standard gerontological treatments. Persistent gene recodings through several longevity treatments should erase the cause of the problem right at the root, or rather, in the seed. It seemed strange that this hadn't been done already, but then Sachs saw that the recommendation was only about 2 decades old. It came from a period after the last time Anne had taken the treatments. For a long time, Sachs sat there, staring at the screen. Much later, he got up. He began to inspect the Reds Medical Clinic, instrument by instrument, room by room. The nursing attendants let him wander. They thought he was distraught. This was a major Red refuge, and it seemed likely to him that one of the rooms might contain the equipment necessary to administer the gerontological treatments. Indeed, it was so. A small room at the back of the clinic appeared to be devoted to the process. It didn't take much. A bulky AI, a small lab, the stock proteins and chemicals, the incubators, the MRIs, the IV equipment. Amazing when you considered what it did. But that had always been true. Life itself was amazing. Simple protein sequences only at the start. And yet here they were. So, the main AI had Anne's genome record. But if he ordered this lab to start synthesizing her DNA strands for her, adding the recodings of HERG and SCN5A, the people here would surely notice, and then there would be trouble. He went back to his tiny room to make a coded call to Da Vinci. He asked his associates there to start the synthesis, and they agreed without any questions beyond the technical ones. Sometimes he loved those saxoclones with all his heart. After that, it was back to waiting. Hours passed. More hours. More hours. Eventually, several days had passed with no change in Anne. The doctor's expression grew blacker and blacker, though she said nothing more about unhooking Anne. But it was in her eye. Sachs took to sleeping on the floor in Anne's room. He grew to know the rhythm of her breathing. He spent a lot of time with a hand cradling her head, as Michel had told him Nergal had done with him. He very much doubted that this had ever cured anybody of anything, but he did it anyway. Sitting for so long in such a posture, he had occasion to think about the brain plasticity treatments that Vlad and Ursula had administered to him after his stroke. Of course, a stroke was a very different thing than a coma. But a change of mind was not necessarily a bad thing if one's mind was in pain. More days passed without a change, each day slower and blanker and more fearful than the one before. The incubators in the Da Vinci labs had long since cooked up a full set of corrected Anne-specific DNA strands and antisense reinforcers and gluons. The whole gerontological package in its latest configuration. So one night he called up Ursula and had a long consultation with her. She answered his questions calmly, even as she struggled with the idea of what he wanted to do. The synaptic stimulus package we gave you would produce too much synaptic growth in undamaged brains, she said firmly. It would alter personality to no set pattern. Creating madmen like Sachs, her alarmed look said. Sachs decided to skip the synaptic supplements. Saving Anne's life was one thing, changing her mind another. Random change was not the goal anyway, acceptance was. Happiness, Anne's true happiness, whatever that might be, now so far away, so hard to imagine, he ached to think of it. It was extraordinary how much physical pain could be generated by thought alone. The limbic system, a whole universe in itself, suffused with pain, like the dark matter that suffused everything in the universe. "Have you talked to Michel?" Ursula asked. "No, good idea." He called Michel, explained what had happened, and what he had in mind to do. "My God, Sax," Michel said, looking shocked. But in only a few moments he was promising to come. He would get Desmond to fly him to Da Vinci to pick up the treatment supplies, and then fly on up to the refuge. So Sax sat in Anne's room, a hand to her head. A bumpy skull. No doubt a phrenologist would have had a field day. Then Michel and Desmond were there, his brothers standing beside him. The doctor was there, too, escorting them, and the tall woman and others as well. So everything had to be communicated by looks, or the absence of looks. Nevertheless, everything was perfectly clear. Desmond's face was, if anything, too clear. They had Anne's longevity package with them. They only had to wait their chance, which came quite soon. With Anne settled into her coma, the situation in the little hospital was routine. The effects of the longevity treatment on a coma, however, were not fully known. Michel had scanned the literature, and the data were sparse. It had been tried as an experimental treatment in a few unresponsive comas before, and had been successful in rousing victims almost half the time. Because of that, Michel now thought it was a good idea. And so, soon after their arrival, the three of them got up in the middle of the night and tiptoed past the sleeping attendant in the medical center's anteroom. Medical training had had its usual effect, and the attendant was sound asleep, though awkwardly propped in her chair. Sax and Michel hooked Anne up to the IVs and stuck the needles in the veins on the backs of her hands, working slowly, carefully, precisely, quietly. Soon she was hooked up, the IVs were flowing, the new protein strands were in her bloodstream. Her breathing grew irregular, and Sax felt hot with fear. He groaned silently. It was comforting to have Michel and Desmond here, each holding an arm as if supporting him, keeping him from falling. But he wished desperately for Hiroko. This was what she would have done, he was certain of it, which made him feel better. Hiroko was one of the reasons he was doing this. Still, he longed for her support, her physical presence. He wished she would show up to help him like she had on Didelia Planitia. To help Anne. She was the expert at this kind of radically irresponsible human experimentation. This would have been small potatoes to her. When the operation was finished, they took out the IV needles and put the equipment away. The attendant slept on, mouth open, looking like the girl she was. Anne was still unconscious, but breathing easier, Sax felt, more strongly. The three men stood looking down at Anne together. Then they slipped out and tiptoed back down the hall to their rooms. Desmond was dancing on his toes like a fool, and the other two shushed him. They got back in their beds but couldn't sleep, and couldn't talk, and so lay there silently, like brothers in a big house, late at night, after a successful expedition out into the nocturnal world. The next morning the doctor came in. "Her vital signs are better." The three men expressed their pleasure at this. Later, down in the dining hall, Sax had a strong urge to tell Michel and Desmond about his encounter with Hiroko. The news would mean more to these two than anyone else. But something in him was afraid to do it. He was afraid of seeming overwrought, perhaps even delusional. That moment when Hiroko had left him at the rover and walked off into the storm, he didn't know what to think of that. In his long hours with Anne, he had done some thinking and some research, and he knew now that Terran climbers alone at high altitude, suffering from oxygen loss, not infrequently hallucinated companion climbers, some kind of doppelganger figure, rescue by anima, and his air tube had been partially clogged.
he said,
"I thought this was what Hiroko would have done." Michelle nodded. "It's bold, I'll hand you that. It has her style."
"No, don't misunderstand me. I'm glad you did it."
"About fucking time, if you ask me," said Desmond. "Someone should have tied her down and made her take the treatment years ago. Oh, my sex, my sex." He laughed happily. "I only hope she doesn't come too as crazy as you did."
"But Sax had a stroke," Michelle said.
"Well," Sax said, concerned to set the record straight, "actually, I was somewhat eccentric before." His two friends nodded, mouths pursed. They were in high spirits, though the situation was still unresolved. Then the tall doctor came in. Anne had come out of her coma. Sax felt that his stomach was still too contracted by tension to take in food, but he noted that he was disposing of a pile of buttered toast quite handily, wolfing it down, in fact.
"But she's going to be very angry at you," Michelle said.
Sax nodded. It was, alas, probable. Likely, even. A bad thought. He didn't want to be struck by her again. Or worse, denied her company. "You should come with us to Earth," Michelle suggested.
"Maya and I are going with the delegation and Nergal."
"There's a delegation going to Earth?"
"Yes, someone suggested it, and it seems like a good idea. We need to have some representatives right there on Earth talking to them, and by the time we get back from that, Anne will have had time to think it over."
"Interesting," Sax said, relieved at the mere suggestion of an escape from the situation. In fact, it was almost frightening how quickly he could think of 10 good reasons for going to Earth. "But what about Pavonis and this conference they're talking about?"
"We can see part of that by video."
"True." It was just what he had always maintained. The plan was attractive. He didn't want to be there when Anne woke up, or rather, when she found out what he had done. Cowardice, of course, but still. "Desmond, are you going?"
"Not a fucking chance."
"But you say Maya is going too?" Sax asked Michelle.
"Yes."
"Good. The last time I tried to save a woman's life, Maya killed her."
"What?
What, Phyllis? You saved Phyllis's life?"
"Well, no. That is to say, I did, but I was also the one who put her in danger in the first place, so I don't think it counts."
He tried to explain what had happened that night in Burrows with little success. It was fuzzy in his own mind, except for certain vivid, horrible moments. "Never mind, it was just a thought. I shouldn't have spoken,
"You're tired," Michelle said. "But don't worry. Maya will be away from the scene here and safely under our eye."
Sax nodded. It was sounding better all the time. Give Anne some time to cool off, think it over, understand. Hopefully. And it would be very interesting, of course, to see conditions on Earth firsthand. Extremely interesting. So interesting that no rational person could pass up the opportunity. Part 3. A New Constitution. Ants came to Mars as part of the soil project, and soon they were everywhere, as is their way. And so the little red people encountered ants, and they were amazed. These creatures were just the right size to ride. It was like the Native Americans meeting the horse. Tame the things, and they would run wild. Domesticating the ant was no easy matter. The little red scientists hadn't even believed such creatures were possible because of surface area to volume constraints. But there they were, clumping around like intelligent robots, so the little red scientists had to explain them. To get some help, they climbed up into the humans' reference books and read up on ants. They learned about the ants' pheromones. and they synthesized the ones they needed to control the soldier ants of a particularly small, docile red species, and after that they were in business. Little Red Cavalry. They charged around everywhere on ant back, having a fine old time, 20 or 30 of them on each ant, like pashas on elephants. Look close at enough ants, and you'll see them. Right there on top. But the little red scientists continued to read the texts and learned about human pheromones. They went back to the rest of the little red people, awestruck and appalled. "Now we know why these humans are such trouble," they reported. "Humans have no more will than these ants we're riding around on. They're giant meat ants." The little red people tried to comprehend such a travesty of life. Then a voice said, "No, they're not," to all of them at once. The little red people talked to each other telepathically, you see, and this was like a telepathic loudspeaker announcement. "Humans are spiritual beings," this voice insisted. "How do you know?" the little red people asked telepathically. "Who are you? Are you the ghost of John Boone?" "I am the Jatso Rinpoche," the voice answered. "The 18th reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. I am traveling the Bardo in search of my next reincarnation. I've looked everywhere on Earth, but I've had no luck, and I decided to look somewhere new. Tibet is still under the thumb of the Chinese, and they show no signs of letting up. The Chinese, although I love them dearly, are hard bastards, and the other governments of the world long ago turned their backs on Tibet, so no one will challenge the Chinese. Something needs to be done, so I came to Mars."
"Good idea," the little red people said.
"Yes," the Dalai Lama agreed. "But I must admit I am having a hard time finding a new body to inhabit. For one thing, there are very few children anywhere. Then also, it doesn't look like anyone is interested. I looked in Sheffield, but everyone was too busy talking. I went to Sabashi, but everyone there had their heads stuck in the dirt. I went to Elysium, but everyone had assumed the lotus position and could not be roused. I went to Christianopolis, but everyone there had other plans. I went to Hiranyagarbha, but everyone there said, 'We've already done enough for Tibet.' I've gone everywhere on Mars, to every tent and station, and everywhere people are just too busy. No one wants to be the 19th Dalai Lama, and the Bardo is getting colder and colder." "Good luck," the little red people said. "We've been looking ever since John died, and we haven't even found anyone worth talking to, much less living inside. These big people are all messed up." The Dalai Lama was discouraged by this response. He was getting very tired and couldn't last much longer in the Bardo. So he said, "What about one of you?"
"Well, sure," the little red people said. "We'd be honored. Only it will have to be all of us at once. We do everything like that together."
"Why not?" said the Dalai Lama. And he transmigrated into one of the little red specks, and that same instant he was there in all of them, all over Mars. The little red people looked up at the humans crashing around above them, a sight which before they had tended to regard as some kind of bad widescreen movie, and now they found they were filled with all the compassion and wisdom of the 18 previous lives of the Dalai Lama. They said to each other, "Kawow! These people really are messed up. We thought it was bad before, but look at that, it's even worse than we thought. They're lucky they can't read each other's minds or they'd kill each other. That must be why they're killing each other. They know what they're thinking themselves, and so they suspect all the others. How ugly. How sad." "They need your help," the Dalai Lama said inside them all. Maybe you can help them.
Maybe,
the little red people said. They were dubious, to tell the truth. They had been trying to help humans ever since John Boone died. They had set up whole towns in the porches of every ear on the planet and talked continuously ever since, sounding very much like John had, trying to get people to wake up and act decent, and never with any effect at all, except to send a lot of people to ear, nose, and throat specialists. Lots of people on Mars thought they had tinnitus, but no one ever understood their little red people. It was enough to discourage anyone. But now the little red people had the compassionate spirit of the Dalai Lama infusing them, and so they decided to try one more time. Perhaps it will take more than whispering in their ears, the Dalai Lama pointed out, and they all agreed. We'll have to get their attention some other way. Have you tried your telepathy on them? The Dalai Lama asked. Oh, no, they said. No way. Too scary. The ugliness might kill us on the spot, or at least make us real sick. Maybe not, the Dalai Lama said. Maybe if you blocked off your reception of what they thought and just beamed your thoughts at them, it would be all right. Just send lots of good thoughts, like an advice beam. Compassion, love, agreeableness, wisdom, even a little common sense. We'll give it a try, the little red people said. But we're all going to have to shout at the top of our telepathic voices, all in chorus, because these folks just aren't listening. I've faced that for 9 centuries now, the Dalai Lama said. You get used to it. And you little ones have the advantage of numbers, so give it a try. And so all the little red people all over Mars looked up and took a deep breath. Art Randolph was having the time of his life. Not during the battle for Sheffield, of course. That had been a disaster, a breakdown of diplomacy, the failure of everything Art had been trying to do. A miserable few days, in fact, during which he had run around sleeplessly, trying to meet with every group he thought might help defuse the crisis, and always with the feeling that it was somehow his fault, that if he had done things right, it would not have happened. The fight went right to the brink of torching Mars, as in 2061. For a few hours on the afternoon of the Red Assault, it had teetered, but fallen back. Something, diplomacy or the realities of battle, a defensive victory for those on the cable, common sense, sheer chance, something had tipped things back from the edge. And with that nightmare interval past, people had returned to East Pavonis in a thoughtful mood. The consequences of failure had been made clear. They needed to agree on a plan. Many of the radical Reds were dead or escaped into the outback, and the moderate Reds left in East Pavonis, while angry, were at least there. It was a very uncomfortable and uncertain period, but there they were. So once again, Art began flogging the idea of a constitutional Congress. He ran around under the big tent through warrens of industrial warehouses and storage zones and concrete dormitories, down broad streets crowded with a museum's worth of heavy vehicles, and everywhere he urged the same thing. Constitution. He talked to Nadia, Nergal, Jackie, Zake, Maya, Peter, Ariadne, Rashid, Tariki, Nanao, Sung, and H.X. Sporjani. He talked to Vlad and Ursula and Marina, and to the coyote. He talked to a few score young natives he had never met before, all major players in the recent unrest. There were so many of them, it began to seem like a textbook demonstration of the polycephalous nature of mass social movements. And to every head of this new Hydra, Art made the same case. A constitution would legitimate us to Earth, and it would give us a framework for settling disputes among ourselves. and we're all gathered here, we could start right away. Some people have plans ready to look at. And with the events of the past week fresh in their minds, people would nod and say, maybe so, and wander off thinking about it. Art called up William Fort and told him what he was doing and got an answer back later the same day. The old man was at a new refugee town in Costa Rica, looking just as distracted as always. Sounds good, he said. And after that, Praxis people were checking with Art daily to see what they could do to help organize things. Art became busier than he had ever been, doing what the Japanese there called nemawashi, the preparations for an event. Starting strategy sessions for an organizing group, revisiting everyone he had spoken to before, trying, in effect, to talk to every individual on Pavonis Mons. The John Boone method, Coyote commented with his cracked laugh. Good luck! Sax, packing his few belongings for the diplomatic mission to Earth, said, you should invite the United Nations. Sax's adventure in the storm had knocked him back a bit. He tended to stare around at things, as if stunned by a blow to the head. Art said gently, Sax, we just went to a lot of trouble to kick their butts off this planet. Yes, Sax said, staring at the ceiling. But now, co-opt them. Co-opt the UN. Art considered it. Co-opt the United Nations. It had a certain ring to it. It would be a challenge, diplomatically speaking. Just before the ambassadors left for Earth, Nergal came by the Praxis offices to say goodbye. Embracing his young friend, Art was seized with a sudden irrational fear. Off to Earth! Nergal was as blithe as ever, his dark brown eyes alight with anticipation. After saying goodbye to the others in the outer office, he sat with Art in an empty corner room of the warehouse. Are you sure you want to do this? Art asked. Very sure. I want to see Earth. Art waggled a hand, uncertain what to say. Besides, Nergal added, someone has to go down there and show them who we are. None better for that than you, my friend. But you'll have to watch out for the Metanats. Who knows what they'll be up to? And for bad food, those areas affected by the flood are sure to have problems with sanitation. And disease vectors, and you'll have to be careful about sunstroke. You'll be very susceptible. Jackie Boone walked in. Art stopped his travel advisory. Nergal was no longer listening in any case, but watching Jackie with a suddenly blank expression, as if he had put on a Nergal mask. And of course, no mask could do justice to Nergal, because the mobility of his face was its essential characteristic. So he didn't look like himself at all. Jackie, of course, saw this instantly. Shut off from her old partner, naturally she glared at him. Something had gone awry, Art saw. Both of them had forgotten Art, who would have slipped out of the room if he could have, feeling like he was holding a lightning rod in a storm. But Jackie was still standing in the doorway, and Art didn't care to disturb her at the moment. So you're leaving us, she said to Nergal. It's just a visit. But why? Why now? Earth means nothing to us now. It's where we came from. It is not. We came from Zygote. Nergal shook his head. Earth is the home planet. We're an extension of it here. We have to deal with it. Jackie waved a hand in disgust, or bafflement. You're leaving just when you're needed here the most. Think of it as an opportunity. I will, she snapped. He had made her angry. And you won't like it. But you'll have what you want. Fiercely, she said. You don't know what I want. The hair on the back of Art's neck had raised. Lightning was about to strike. He would have said he was an eavesdropper by nature, almost a voyeur, in fact. But standing right there in the room was not the same, and he found now there were some things he didn't care to witness. He cleared his throat. The other two were startled by his noise. With a waggle of the hand, he sidled past Jackie and out the door. Behind him, the voices went on, bitter, accusatory, filled with pain and baffled fury. Coyote stared gravely out the windshield as he drove the ambassadors to Earth, south to the elevator, with Art sitting beside him. They rolled slowly through the battered neighborhoods that bordered the socket in the southwest part of Sheffield, where the streets had been designed to handle enormous freight container gantries so that things had an ominous spear-esque quality to them, inhuman and gigantic. Sachs was explaining once again to Coyote that the trip to Earth wouldn't remove the travelers from the Constitutional Congress, that they would contribute by vid, that they would not end up like Thomas Jefferson in Paris, missing the whole thing. "We'll be on Pavonis," Sachs said, "in all the senses that matter." "Then everyone will be on Pavonis," Coyote said ominously. He didn't like this trip to Earth for Sachs and Maya and Michelle and Nergal. He didn't seem to like the Constitutional Congress. Nothing these days pleased him. He was jumpy, uneasy, irritable. "We're not out of the woods yet," he would mutter. "You mark my words." Then the socket stood before them, the cable emerging black and glossy from the great mass of concrete, like a harpoon plunged into Mars by earthly powers, holding it fast. After identifying themselves, the travelers drove right into the complex, down a big straight passageway to the enormous chamber at the center, where the cable came down through the socket's collar and hovered over a network of pistes crisscrossing the floor. The cable was so exquisitely balanced in its orbit that it never touched Mars at all, but merely hung there with its 10-meter diameter end floating in the middle of the room, the collar in the roof doing no more than stabilizing it. For the rest, its positioning was up to the rockets installed up and down the cable and, more importantly, to the balance between centrifugal force and gravity, which kept it in its aerosynchronous orbit. A row of elevator cars floated in the air like the cable itself, though for a different reason, as they were electromagnetically suspended.
This ends side one of cassette 4. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.